So we come to Canto 33 of the Purgatory, the last. And it's quietly quite an extraordinary canto. It's one much discussed for Beatrice's prophecies. But to cut to the chase, I think it is the canto in which Dante fully is invited to come into his own. In terms of the story, he's invited to become fully human again. Remember, he's been in this suspended state of innocence, and he's invited to drink of the waters of the second stream that restore his will, understanding, and memory, but without the burden, and so to become complete for paradise. But that's also to say that he's being invited to become ready, capable of all that he might be capable of as a human being, so that all his potential can be actualized. Remember, part of Beatrice's charge is that he played fast and loose with his gifts. He wasn't able fully to incarnate all that was promised at his conception, when the influences of the cosmos and the divine spirit was breathed into his soul. And she's now going to tell him, you're ready for this, given all that's happened. This is what we're embarking on now. It also means that he's going to understand love properly at the last two, in the last canticle in the paradise. He's going to understand how this perceptual capacity of resonating with all things through human intelligence that can connect with divine intelligence, all that's going to connect with the desire, the love, the passion, the beauty of things. And that is part of what is signalled through this canto. And then finally, and perhaps most surprisingly of all, well, half surprisingly, Dante is commissioned, you might say, by Beatrice to become the poet of her words, to become the means by which all that she's going to show him, all that she's going to reveal to him, can be communicated to people back on Earth, including us, of course. And I think she signals in that, not that just he's getting his artistic vocation clear at the last, but he also is being called to become the prophet of a new dispensation within Christianity. His poetry marks a new turn in this Christian story, expanding it from what it had been before, renewing it from the ways that it had become fallen, and bringing it to us 700 years on, so that it can speak still of spiritual transformation, the heart, I think, of Christianity. Remember, Jesus repeatedly said, have you the eyes to see, have you the ears to hear, much more than anything else he says in the Gospels. And it's a story of transformation that the church struggles with, in my view, still now. And Dante is going to show us in the paradise, insofar as is at all possible, what that transformation is fully about. And it's going to be quite as surprising as everything that's happened in the Inferno and Purgatory already. And this is the canto that sets us up now. Canto 33 of the Purgatory sets us up for the third and final stage of the journey, which is going to carry us to the stars, is the most expansive of the lot. So how does this all unfold? How is this intimated? The canto begins with Beatrice and the seven ladies, the four traditional virtues and the three new Christian virtues of faith, hope and love, bitterly lamenting what they've seen. Remember, they've seen this enactment of how the church, how Christian souls how the world falls from the divine, taking us right up to the present moment, certainly up to Dante's moment in time, and as I try to articulate it, showing that the dynamics which the various parts of the scenes depicted are quite as active and prevalent now. And so the ladies lament that, and they do so by citing a psalm which goes, "O Lord, the Gentiles are come into your holy temples." And I think this is not as if non-Christians, as it were, have found their way into the church. This is that the church itself has come to misunderstand what it's all about. It's become, as it were, a Gentile. And that is the depth of the trouble that Christianity finds itself in the 14th century, in the present moment, in my view. And it's the depth of that problem that signals the height of what this canto really is indicating. That is the extent of the trouble, and that indicates the profundity of the remedy. I think this is not just about a kind of new push, a new renewal, a new effort. This is about something being remade, and Dante is going to find himself at the heart of that. Beatrice, after the lament, becomes bright again. It says that she stands like a flame. She becomes resolute. She's got a purpose. And she quotes the words of Jesus to indicate this. Jesus' words in John's Gospel, where he had said to his disciples, "In a little while you will no longer see me, and then again in a little while and you will see me." It was the prophecy of his death which would take them away from him before he returns to them to commission them. And I think that this is Beatrice saying that pattern is what's going to happen now. If Christ has become invisible to the church because of all the misunderstandings, Christ is going to become visible again through a return. And it's that return which she's going to talk about now. She organizes the seven ladies in front of her. The virtues lead the way, they make possible the way, they open up the way, because they open our sight to see the way. And then Dante and Statius and the lady who's been helping them stand behind Beatrice. And they walk about 10 steps before Beatrice turns back to Dante, and turns back in a moment that begins to indicate the new relationship which she now wants him to have with her, and which he's going to continue to struggle with. But she begins to signal that now by saying to him, "Stay close, keep hasty, so that you can hear the words that I want to speak to you." She calls Dante brother, which is quite remarkable given how she had so recently been chastising him. But remember, the reproaches were always on the premise that there was already a key place for him. That lovely intimacy starts to pervade the canticle, the canto. She'd already said to the virtues, actually, calling them sister, "My sister's so dear to me." There's something generally about everyone's vocation, everyone's calling to this renewal that's beginning to be indicated. But maybe not surprisingly, Dante can't take it in. He's gobsmacked. He struggles for words. He's still sort of reeling from all that he's experienced and what he's seen as well. And so instead of being able to engage with the various visions and experiences he's had, he sort of falls back onto his own ways and says, "But, you know, you know my mind. You know how to satisfy all my desires perfectly." And she turns around to him again and says, "Look, step out of the dream. This is about you becoming someone now as well. that's what she wants to pass on to him. She says that the vessel that once was has been broken. This is apocalyptic language. It's referring back to the chariot, I think, but also referring to the church, the receptacle that is supposed to be able to instantiate, to incarnate the divine life. That has been broken. And she says that God won't hinder to remake things, to have his vengeance, to put it in the stronger way. He will claim the chariot once more that became monstrous and then was stolen away by the giant and the whore, those personifications of power and lust, completely ill-directed, will be addressed by God, she says. They will be superseded. And she embarks on a prophecy that has led to lots of discussion. Many of the commentators now go for the allegorical meanings, as we've come to expect, and they try to match what she says here with events that happened either during the last part of Dante's life or perhaps some kind of future expectation for the renewal of the church or maybe the renewal of the empire, the healing of the Italian civil wars in history. But I'm reaching for the tropological senses, the senses which have this deeper spiritual meaning, one that follows the energy that might remake us rather than the actual form and details of what may or may not have actually happened. And so it's here, I think, that she's indicating something of a new dispensation, a shift of human consciousness, a radical change within Christianity. And she says that she can sense the stars are assembling that indicate this. I think this is at once a sort of astrological reference. There's a new influence, a new inflow coming into the cosmos. But remember, stars are also deities. And so it's as if there's new divine presence coming into the world as well. She says that actually she feels they're already near. And then she starts to talk of God's emissary coming into the world to overturn the power and the lust, the mistaken desire to kill the giant and the whore. And she does so by referring to the appearance of 5:10:5. And this is one of those mysterious utterances that sends numerologists off in all directions. Most commentators understand this as a reference to the Roman numerals of D, X, and V that can then be shifted around to spell D, U, X. U and V are substitutable in Roman numbers, and so it becomes an anagram of D, U, X, Dux, which stands for leader. And so in the allegorical reading, this suggests that Beatrice is forecasting a new leader on earth, a new secular ruler, a new emperor perhaps, who will heal divisions and bring things together. But I suspect that something else is going on here, that this dux, this leader, is something in a way more humdrum, more humble, but at the same time far more powerful, renewing from the inside out, not the outside in, as secular politics would try to do. You know, remember that Dante lives after the time of Francis and lots of other mendicant friars, these little people who were seen to be renewing the church from the bottom up, bringing in a completely new vision of things about which the church authorities felt very, very uncomfortable indeed. And I think Dante tells us that this is what he's signalling now, because Beatrice tells Dante, the pilgrim, that her seeming riddle will be understood in much the same way that the riddle of Themis and the riddle of the Sphinx were understood. So these are allusions to the famous classical stories. And the riddle of Themis was broken when it was realized that she was talking about putting the bones behind you. So these were the bones of the dead, and she says they need to be put behind you, which is to say to step into a new future. And it's much like Jesus's remark of letting the dead bury their dead. You know, quite challenging in its own way. People would regard burying the dead as a sacred duty, if not something decent and human to do. But what this riddle of Themis is suggesting is that I'm indicating something now that is so radical that it's going to seem like a wrench to step into this new future. But then that's countered by the riddle of the Sphinx, which Beatrice refers to as well. And you remember that the riddle of the Sphinx was who or what walks on four legs in the morning, two legs at noon, and then three legs in the afternoon. And the answer was a man, human beings, because we crawl when we're young, we walk, stand and walk when we're adults, and then carry a stick to prop us up when we're old. And so this is an indication that the riddle is pointing towards a human being, an everyman, someone who maybe is one of these humble figures. And so it leads you to ask, precisely who is she talking about if she's not referring to a great leader, a great dux? Something that seems to be underscored because she also tells Dante that this renewal will come about without the loss of life, as political or military change would inevitably entail, certainly at the time. And I think she answers her riddle straight away, as riddles tend to do, but in a way that is completely obscure to Dante at the time and remains almost breathtakingly audacious to us now, and so seems quite obscure too. Because she turns straight to Dante and she says to Dante, "Mark my words, write them down, tell people back on earth what you have seen and what I am telling you." This, I think, is the answer to the riddle, what Dante is going to become as a poet and as a human being, and what he's going to communicate to us. She tells him to write of how life is a race to the death, one of the famous phrases from the Divine Comedy. This life really matters because it's a preparation for the next life. It's the time where we become capable of more life, both now, but in particular because now is just a reflection of the next life. She tells him to speak of the two falls that he's just seen enacted out in Canto 32. So this is the aboriginal fall from the pre-lapsarian to the post-lapsarian state, when alienation and distress entered the world, but when also there was the happy fault that led to the possibility of Christ's incarnation and the human individual coming to know the fullness of divine life. But that led to the second fall, which he also saw, the fall of humanity, the fall of the church, when the cart becomes overgrown, when it's stolen by the giant and the whore. So she tells him to write about those things as well. And she says, reminds them that Adam waited 5,000 years for the new dispensation, for the birth of Christ, that could remedy what went wrong before. 5,000 years is the poetic reference to the time since the creation of the world. I'm just in parenthesis, I don't think it's anything meant literally. Time has this symbolic, qualitative meaning in these kind of contexts. It means a very long time. It wasn't till the scientific revolution that things were taken so literally. So she says, remind people of the huge long wait, the pain, the agony that Adam went through before his own redemption. And that is what you're facing now, that agony, that pain, waiting for something new. She says to him, I know that your mind is clouded. I know that it seems dark and petrified, not understanding what on earth is being said. And in a way, how could it be? Because she's saying to him, I'm going to bring about something new, I think, in him, that is going to be a renewal that therefore is not possible of seeing right now. You know, otherwise, people could have got on with it right now. People could get on with it right now. Now, this is a shift of consciousness that requires reaching and receiving something that is radically different, putting the bones behind you. And that is why, at this moment in Canto 3, his mind feels ossified. It feels dark. He can't understand the words that she's speaking. And he says, you know, your words seem too lofty for me. The more you speak, the higher they seem to go, and so recede from my sight. And she says, well, of course, that's right, because what this is about is climbing the inverted tree. She says, if you understood the meaning of the inverted tree, you would understand what I'm talking about. Remember, the tree is inverted because it grows out. The closer it comes to the divine, the further it reaches into heaven. And it's of great height. It can't be climbed in the normal ways, both because of its great height and also because of its strange pattern of growth. A different way of ascending is required. It's not just a question of, as it were, grabbing from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and consuming it. Something far more radical has got to happen. Something at once utterly surprising and completely amazing has got to happen. And she says, look, if you don't know what I'm talking about now, at least remember my words and write them down. And he says his words are imprinted on him like wax imprints, is imprinted by a stamp. He will do that at least. It's a nice illusion because it's sort of saying that we can speak about these things if we're not conscious of quite what they mean, but attempting to speak about them, attempting to wrestle with them, is precisely what starts to bring them to consciousness. And so that's a nice understanding of his poetry. To read the words, to wrestle with them, is to gradually bring what they're really referring to into our minds, which of course is itself to become transformed, because we only understand things when they actually resonate with us, when they become part and parcel of who we are. She says that what this is about exceeds even the new learning that Dante has been drawing on, particularly through the figure of Virgil, so far in the Inferno and the Purgatory. So this is the new learning both of Aristotle's insights from the pre-Christian world, I think implicitly the Islamic insights that have given Dante even the idea that the afterlife might be so gradually and finely tiered that itself might be a kind of path and a journey. But also the new insights of figures like Thomas Aquinas, who have brought these various facets together and been giving Christianity a new lease of life. Beatrice says that you're going to have those kind of new learnings put to the test in this third and final stage. She says you're going to discover that what is revealed to you is as far from what your mind has grasped thus far, amazing though that is, as the earth is from the prima mobile, from the highest heavens. It's a nice metaphor of how transcendent are God's ways, even as he communicates them to human beings. But of course, is also a prophecy of where Dante is going next in the paradise, because he will travel to the prima mobile, and in fact, straight through it and beyond. That's the extent of what is being promised. In the way that Dante the poet often does in these very elevated moments, he has the next person speak in a very humble, human way, a touching way. And Dante, the pilgrim, says to Beatrice at this point, but I've never felt estranged from you. I've never felt that there's a gap between us, you know, as earth is distant from the high heavens. And she kind of chuckles at him and says, oh, that's the Lethe speaking. Don't you remember that you just drunk from the waters of forgetfulness earlier that morning? He's been released from the burden of his sins. He's in this kind of state of angelic innocence, as it were, only staring into her eyes, only staring into the mind of God. But all that he is as a human being, his will, memory, and understanding will be returned to him if without the sense of burden that dragged him down. and he will rise, she says, and she will speak to him plainly so that he can understand, so that all this insight can be communicated to him. And as if to celebrate the moment that Beatrice has spoken, if in riddles, of this quiet revolution, Dante tells the time for the last time in Purgatory. You'll remember how telling the time has been quite a feature of our journey. And he says now that the sun is at its zenith. It's blazing more brightly in the sky than it does at any other times of day. And as if our nearest star is celebrating what Beatrice has been speaking about. That Dante has been talking about something which is going to be completely strange and unexpected is indicated by what happens next, because it's said that the seven ladies stop suddenly as if they come to an unexpected place. I don't suppose this place was strange or unexpected to them at all, so you feel that they're acting out to show us in quite a playful way how strange and unexpected what Beatrice has been saying truly is. And they're now in a cool and shady place. It's a place of refreshment, it's a place of relaxation. The mood is kind of settling as we come towards the end of the canto. But there's still more surprises for Dante, because they stop in front of a spring. And it's a spring that Dante sees that gives birth to water, and then the waters divide and they form into two streams that become two rivers. And he's really surprised by this. And again, it makes you wonder quite why, because a spring giving birth to two rivers is not a wholly supernatural thing to occur. But I think it's a way of Dante the pilgrim speaking about divine things, even though he doesn't know what he's talking about, because he describes this one becoming two in a way that is powerfully reminiscent of God's oneness becoming two and then becoming three in the Trinity. And that threeness is intimated because, in a way, Dante's talking about water, and the water of the Spirit therefore is present in the one becoming two. The one stream becoming two streams, the one water becoming two waters. There's already a third implicit in that. But then also he turns to Beatrice and he addresses her as the Holy Wisdom. He says, O light, O wisdom of the peoples of the earth, what is this one becoming two or about? So this is at the same time the Spirit which can illuminate our minds. So in this nice touch, when Dante is apparently only seeing two streams emerging from a spring, he's already talking about the most tremendous divine mysteries. At the end of the Purgatory, we're getting a foretaste of what will come at the end of the Paradise. It's a vision of things to come, and Dante's speaking about it without even knowing that he's speaking about it, a reflection of his current innocent state. In response to his question, Beatrice says, ask Matilda. And she finally reveals the name of the lady that's been accompanying them, and the lady whose life resonates with the life of the place, who's been helping Dante through the Lethe so much. She answers and says to Beatrice, well, I did tell him before, and he shouldn't have forgotten that detail, because the Lethe is not just about wiping your memory, it's about wiping the burden of your sins so that you can be free. And Beatrice responds in a lovely, humane way again, and says, look, Matilda, I guess he's had other things on his mind, i.e. he's been seeing her, and that is quite enough to wipe more recent memories from his mind in the absorption, in the way that he's found that overwhelming and tremendous. Then Beatrice says to Matilda, you know, fulfill one of your purposes here. She gives her blessing to Matilda's task, which is to guide Dante, and in fact Statius. Matilda turns to Statius and takes him by the hand and says, you come through, you come too. And it's to guide them through the waters of the second stream, through the waters of the Eunoe, the good-mindedness, the stream that returns these individuals to their human capacities with will and understanding, but because their will and is now aligned with their desire, with love, they're now free to pursue that fully as well and not be burdened by the shame of the past, but also not forgetting the past, because you know the past is part of who they are and they must come towards the divine with everything they've got. We must not try to cut things off in order to approach the divine. We must work things through and bring all that, because in the divine grace it's going to turn out that that is really important as well, redeemed. And so the canticle ends, and the canto ends with Dante turning to us readers and saying that he hasn't got time now to find the words that could describe the sweetness of those waters. And it's a beautiful moment because it takes us right into the action with him addressing us at the end of the purgatory. It's not just an intimate touch as a reader, but is Dante saying, this story is about you as much as it's about me. It's about the eternal vision for us all, as it is about my own life as a poet, my own life, and what my love of Beatrice led me to. It's a complete embrace at the end of the poem. And the final tercet concludes with Dante saying that he was now ready to rise. He was pure in the sense that his intention was ready. He was remade. He uses a very powerful metaphor to describe that. He says that he was remade like a tree that bursts into new life. Powerful because, of course, we'd seen the tree of the knowledge of good and evil bursting into new life. Again, indicating that Dante is now onto nothing less than a completely new dispensation, a completely new moment in Christian history. And so he says that he's now ready to rise to the stars. Stars is the last word in the purgatory, as it has been in the inferno, and indeed as it will be in the paradise. And luckily for us, Dante is also ready to write about his final ascent in the paradise.